zoology from the University of Maine and his PhD in immunology from Uppsala University in Sweden. And he has a range of research interests, including the nitrification and regulation of algal biomass and secondary production in lakes. He also looks at aquatic food web processes and pesticide impacts on aquatic biology. We're really looking forward to this talk today on fatty acids. So let's give a warm welcome to Professor Michael Brett.
Thank you. If I can get the lights out in the front row, that'll help me out a little bit. So today, I'm going to go over kind of the basic story of fatty acids and try to make the point that it's the kind of thing that if you were a stream ecologist, you might actually be pretty interested, or that you ought to be pretty interested in. Those of you who are vaguely familiar with fatty acids have probably heard things like trans fatty acids, and you've probably heard about omega-3s and omega-6s and saturated fatty acids, some being good, some being bad, and it's all kind of a big mishmash and a little bit confusing. Polyunsaturates get thrown in there as well. And I'll touch on a lot of those different things, and what I'll do is I'll talk about these molecules within an ecological context and try to explain to you why I think they are extremely important for how aquatic food webs behave. So the basic argument starts with the molecules, and so there's various categories of fatty acids that I'll talk about, and I'll put a lot of emphasis down here towards the bottom on these omega-6 and omega-3s and essential fatty acids, and we'll talk about what all those things mean and why they're interesting. The saturated fatty acids are the ones that we're familiar with in hard oils at room temperature. So butter is a saturated fatty acid, mostly. Polyunsaturates, we know those in the nutrition as, for example, olive oil. Everybody's heard of the Mediterranean diet. Olive oil is good for you. It's mostly oleic acid. It actually got its name from olives, oleic acid. And then the other ones that we hear a lot about are the polyunsaturates. And these, I'll show you later on some images of these molecular structures, but the key thing is whether they have saturated bonds exclusively or they have some number of unsaturated bonds, and that has a tremendous impact on the properties of these molecules. So in the omega-6 series, there's linoleic, and then arachidonic are really important, and in the omega-3 series, there's alpha-linolenic, which we know from linseed oil. It's very abundant in linseed oil. And then eicosapinoic acid and docosahexaenoic acid, which are real tongue twisters, which you know as fish oil. And one of the important points that I want to make today is that the molecules that you know as fish oil and that you read about in newspapers and say they're associated with depression, they're used as secondary treatments for depression, hyperactivity, they're associated with lower rates of cardiovascular disease, lower rates of stroke, and much lower rates of a broad range of cancer. These things that we associate with fish oil, they're all actually produced by algae at the base of the food web, and they just accumulate in food webs in fish that we eat. But those molecules are only produced by plants. And I'll talk a lot about how they make their way from plants up into things, upper trophic levels. And that's one of the reasons why they're called essential fatty acids. They're called essential fatty acids because plants make them, animals can't. And so for animals, they're essential. We have to get them from our diet. And these are the molecules that you read the most about in the popular literature. There's another categories of players in here, or another name actually called the highly unsaturated fatty acids. And all that means is you got the polys. So a saturated fatty acid means it doesn't have any unsaturated bonds. A monounsaturated means it has one. Poly means it has at least two. And then the highlys tend to have four, five, or six. So they have a lot more of these unsaturated bonds, and it has very important impacts on the molecular properties. And this is just a picture of alpha-linolenic acid. And so the basic story here is that there's this sequence of potential transformations within fatty acids. There's a series of elongations and desaturations, and the basic story is that you can start out with a saturated fatty acid, a plant can desaturate that to oleic acid, and then a plant can further change that into the, or desaturate or desaturate that into the omega-3 series here and the omega-6 series here. But the key thing to keep in mind is that this transformation right here can only be done by plants. The rest of these down here can be done by animals to varying degrees, but this one right here can only be done by plants. So that's going from a monounsaturate to a polyunsaturate. The only thing that has the enzymes to do this is plants, and this is really important for how these molecules behave in aquatic systems, why they're important in aquatic systems, and why they, you know, ultimately influence human health. That's the key thing right there. So one of the other things that's very interesting about these molecules is that especially the highly unsaturated fatty acids have very important physiological properties. They're very important for a variety of things that I'll talk about. One of which, especially for cold-blooded organisms like in streams or lakes or oceans, is that they're very extremely important for maintaining membrane fluidity. So they're maintaining the physical properties of biological membranes. And biological membranes have something called a lipid bilayer. Now, lipid bilayer is comprised of different types of fatty acids. And one of the important things about these fatty acids is that that bilayer has to be fluid. If that bilayer crystallizes, then the animal will die. The layer will fail. And what do I mean by crystallize? What would that mean? Well, if you think of butter, your stick of butter at room temperature, that is a crystal. It's in its solid form. If you heat that up, it melts. It's in a liquid form. So it's whether the membrane takes on a solid form or kind of a fluid form. And the types of fatty acids that are in these membranes are extremely important in that regard because they have very, very different melting points. So, for example, we all know, I've used butter several times as an example because it has a lot of saturated fatty acids, and it also tends to be solid at room temperature. If we look up here, we see stearic acid, which is one of the most common saturated fatty acids, has a melting point of 70 degrees Celsius. So at 70 degrees Celsius, this will go from a solid to a liquid. If we take oleic acid, which I told you already is the dominant component of olive oil, it has a melting point of 14 degrees Celsius. And you'll notice that if you take, for example, olive oil and you put it in the fridge, it will gel, but if you leave it at room temperature, it will be a liquid. And that's because of this 14 degrees Celsius melting point. Alpha-linolenic acid, which is the building block for the omega-3 series of fatty acids, has a melting point of minus 11 degrees Celsius. And docosahexaenoic acid has a melting point of minus 45. So almost 100 degrees or more than 100 degrees difference in the melting point be just by going from predominantly going from degrees of unsaturation. This molecule has 6 unsaturated bonds. I mean, I could explain what these things actually mean here, but it describes how long the molecule is. The first number describes how long the molecule is. The second describes how many unsaturated bonds it has. And the last designation there, this omega designation, describes the position of the first double bond. But the basic point is, as you insert more double bonds into this molecule, it becomes more irregular. When it's a saturated fatty acid, it has a nice straight chain like this, very uniform. And because it has that nice uniform chain, it can very easily crystallize. It can freeze, essentially, is what it's doing. But this DHA molecule, as you can see here, is very contorted, and it does not do that to nearly the same extent. Now, DHA, you're wondering, you read a lot about that in newspapers and stuff. One of the little interesting factoids about that is that your brain is 20% DHA. Your eye tissue is about 40% DHA. And I was reading an article over the weekend. It was something one of these, you know, you hear about omega-3s a lot on the radio these days, and somebody's saying, well, did you know hummingbird mussels have a very high content of DHA? And so I read that, and it turned out that hummingbird mussels, the ones that they use, I think they beat like something like 80 times a second, have the highest DHA content of any known animal mussels, something like 25% DHA within their muscle tissue. Your heart has a very high DHA content in all of your nervous tissues. I mean, obviously, I've already said that your brain and your eyes, but nervous tissues in general have a very, very high DHA content. So they're important for this fluidity perspective, but they're also important in some ways that we don't understand. They're also very important in ways that we do understand. It's been worked out very well. I don't know if it's 20 years ago, 25 years ago, the Nobel Prize was awarded to a guy named Vance, who figured out that the main way that aspirin affects your body is it blocks the production of hormones from a fatty acid called arachidonic fatty acid, which is one of the most important highly unsaturated fatty acids in the omega-6 series. And so he figured out that this right here is the building block for a whole lot of different types of hormones that affect your body in a very wide variety of ways, and that what aspirin does is it just blocks the production of this. Because what tends to happen with arachidonic acid and inflammation and those type of responses that our body overreacts. It overreacts to the stress that it perceives and produces too much of these hormones. You get inflammation, those hormones, the inflammation, the fever, all that, those responses are coming from the hormones that your body's produced from this arachidonic acid. One of the things that's really important, and you'll hear this sometimes when you hear in the popular literature, people are talking about omega-3s, omega-6s, trans, cis's. There's all kinds of different things kind of throwing curveballs at you. But one of the most important things to know is that there's this omega-6 series of fatty acids, there's an omega-3 series of fatty acids, and they both produce a series of hormones, and they use exactly the same enzymes to do this. And so if your body is out of balance of one of these or the other, in terms of the ratio, your body can get an excess of one type of hormone versus the other, and or one series of hormones versus the other. And there's a lot of interest these days in the human physiology literature, and in particular, but it even goes down into the aquatic food web literature, about imbalances between omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids. And the basic story, to kind of make a long story short, is that as we've industrialized our food distribution system, we've shifted our diets very much towards grains and very much towards products that have a very high omega-6 content, because omega-6 doesn't oxidize as fast as omega-3s. And you think, well, who cares whether it oxidizes or not? Well, whether it oxidizes or not has a tremendous impact on its shelf life. So you can put a package of potato chips out there that's loaded up on safflower oil, which is almost probably like 70% omega-6, almost zero omega-3. Leave it out on the shelf there for probably 20 years, you know, at least several months, and it's not going to go bad on you. Something that has a very high omega-3 fatty acid content will go bad on you very quick. You think of fish. Fish goes bad really fast. And so it's a shelf life issue, and our diet has shifted over. And you know, there's this famous book called The Cornification of America. Corn has a very high omega-6 content, and not only do we eat a lot of corn, but we eat things that eat corn. So our diet has been shifted very, very strongly towards omega-6, away from omega-3, and people think that that's responsible for a lot of the diseases that we're, you know, that the modern human is having to deal with, is this imbalance between these ratios. It's believed that Aboriginal humans and kind of believe that the optimal diet would have an omega-3 to omega-6 ratio of about 5 omega-6 to 1 omega-3. And we're somewhere around 30 on average in the United States. So we're like way, 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 way out of balance on that ratio. But the reason that that is important is because these hormones that are produced from these parent molecules, arachidonic acid on the omega-6 series and eicosapinoic acid on the omega-3 series, are following all the same pathways, utilizing the same substrates for these conversions. And if you get too much of one, then you clog up the production of the others. That's a big issue in terms of human nutrition, but also turns out to be fairly important for aquatic systems. So one of the important things, and this is kind of a way too small, but one of the things that's really important to keep in mind is the plants at the base of the food webs, in streams and lakes and oceans and estuaries, even terrestrial plants, vary very dramatically in their fatty acid composition. So certain plants are characterized by a very high saturated fatty acid content, other ones by a very high polyunsaturated fatty acid content. And so the type of things, the type of primary producers that you're likely to see in aquatic systems are very, very different in this regard. And the thing is that you got to keep in mind, as I pointed out before, is that all these fatty acids that we're talking about, or all these essential fatty acids that we're talking about, originate in plants, and most of the ones that we're really interested in actually originate in algae. The vast majority of the ones that we, I mean, the ones, there aren't actually that many molecules, but the ones that we're really interested in, EPA and DHA, are almost exclusively produced by algae. And this is just showing different types of algae, showing that they have very different fatty acid content. So cyanobacteria, that's commonly known as pond scum, it's almost all saturated fatty acids, so you can kind of think of it as like green butter. It's about what it would taste like. And then you got diatoms. All of this is kind of the, you know, the Earth's lungs, so to speak, because they're the dominant primary producers in the ocean, and they're the dominant regulators of the carbon and oxygen cycle for the for the global system. Have very high. This is DHA and this is EPA. There's different designations, and then there's these omega. This is N3 to N6, the same as omega 3 to omega 6 ratio. You can see in aquatic systems, they're very strongly skewed towards omega 3, and terrestrial systems are skewed towards omega 6. And I don't think people quite know why, but that is the case. One of the things that, because these algae have such different fatty acid compositions, we can easily classify them just based on their fatty acid composition. And it's something that people have been using as a taxonomic technique for a long time. People have been using this as a way of classifying things. Now people have gone very much towards molecular approaches and looking at genes, but even this approach is still being used today to try to characterize things. So we can use, you know, pretty simple statistical analysis to take common groups. Like this is commonly known as the green algae. That's what makes the water usually look green. This is cyanobacteria, that's the pond scum. This is diatoms. These are the things, like I said, the dominant primary producers in the ocean, but also very important streams and lakes. And then cryptophytes, which are a fascinating group because they have a very high essential fatty acid content, also very high lipid content. They're just kind of swimming around omega-3 globules, kind of like those little fish capsules, except, you know, take them down a couple of orders of magnitude and put a tail on them, and they're just kind of swimming around in a lake, and that's basically what they are. They're pretty fascinating organisms. And so one of the things that we want to place this in the context of, you know, aquatic systems, food webs, why is this important? Well, one of the things that's pretty interesting that's happened in the last 20 years or so is that we've got this big industry of aquaculture out there. There's a lot of money being spent on fish physiology, trying to figure out basically how much soybean can you feed salmon before the things will get sick. I mean, that's basically what they're trying to figure out, because there's a real limited supply on fish meal, there's overfishing, and there's a lot of pushback on the idea of catching a bunch of small fish, grinding them up, feeding them to big fish so that we can go out to a restaurant and eat them. So what they're trying to do is to alleviate the shortage of fish meal, and they're trying to do it by seeing how much vegetable matter you can mix into it. Well, the crux of that is that they're doing a tremendous amount of research on the physiology of these molecules for fish, and really high-end stuff. I was talking to a guy the other day on the phone from a company called Meritech. Has anybody ever heard of Meritech? Anybody in this room? I get one or two people. Probably people that have kids have heard of Meritech. One of the fascinating things that has happened just in the last few years is that I think the FDA gave the baby formula industry permission to put omega-3 fatty acids into baby formula. And they gave them permission to do this about 6 or 7 years ago. And the industry projections were that within about 10 years, about 50% of baby formula would be supplemented with omega-3s. It turned out that it was within like 3 years, 95% of it was supplemented with omega-3. So anytime you look at baby formula, it's always going to say DHA and ARA. These are these two really important fatty acids that I'm talking about. And Meritech is a company that produces these molecules for the whole world, and they've basically just, you know, monopolized the baby formula market around the world. And what the guy from Meritech was telling me, he says that they've already produced a soybean out there that's been genetically modified to produce these molecules. So it's already made, it's ready just to put out there in the fields and start growing it. So you're going to have soybeans producing fish oil probably out in the market pretty soon. But people have some resistance to GM products, but one thing I can tell you for sure is it's already in baby formula. It's going to be not very long at all before it's in your yogurt and a lot of other things. It's going to get in there. And the only problems that they have right now is just trying to tinker with the product and deal with the fact that it oxidizes so fast, and they have to combine it with some other things like vitamin E and stuff to deal with this oxidation so that it doesn't taste like fish. You don't want to eat yogurt that tastes like fish, but when these molecules start to oxidize, they taste like fish. And so one thing we do experiments with them is that we take them in a laboratory and we work with some of these molecules in their pure form, is that they actually do smell like fish. You know, so the smell of fish is coming from these molecules, especially as they tend to oxidize. But if you can keep that under control, then then, you know, the consumer acceptance of this product will be really high. And you already know that there's this balanced form of margarine. It's not really margarine, it's balanced. And it's the same kind of idea here. They're really playing around with the fatty acid content. And you know, these days people are very sensitive about the, you know, cis versus trans fatty acids. That's a bit of a different story, but there's a big movement towards, you know, consuming the right types of fats. And that's kind of a longabout way of saying that the people that have studied fish physiology have reached the conclusion that the best diet for fish is the diet that the maternal fish gives to the juvenile fish, and that is the yolk. So if you want to know what is the best fatty acid composition, the best ratio between protein and lipids and other components for a fish, and generally speaking, the most important part of the kind of the nutritional physiology of a fish's life history is during its juvenile phase, when they have very high mortality rates. The maternal investment in yolk tells us what those fish have evolutionarily decided is the best, the most important thing. And so what the premier experts in this field, and there's this guy named John Sargent, who's just a superstar in terms of fish physiology and has gotten most of his money to do research related to these aquaculture questions, primarily working with Atlantic salmon, but a few other fish, has concluded that it's the fatty acid composition of eggs tells us what's important. If you look at the fatty acid composition of salmon eggs, and this is just data that I summarized from about 10 different papers, you see that salmon eggs are almost 25% DHA, almost. And they're about 12% EPA. And interestingly enough, the ARA content, that's the arachidonic acid, that's the most physiologically important omega-6 fatty acid, varies quite a bit depending on whether you're talking about anadromous salmon or landlocked salmon. If it's landlocked salmon, it's somewhere around 7%. If it's anadromous and goes to the ocean, it's down around 2%. I guess I'm gabbing too much. And if I can get this thing to come back. Okay, there we go. So the basic story is, if we want to know what is... we have a disaster here. Let's cancel that. If we want to know what is optimal for the upper trophic levels, we can just take this person's advice and say, let's look at what maternal fish invest into larval fish. Look at the yolk. And one of the other things I pointed out to you before is I said to you that the fatty acid content varies tremendously from one phytoplankton group to another. The other thing that we know, based on the type of studies that I've been doing in my lab for a long time, is that the food quality of these algae also varies tremendously. So the ones that tend to have a very high fatty acid content, these diatoms and cryptophytes right up here, are very nutritious. The zooplankton, herbivorous organisms that eat them, grow very fast. And the things down here that have very little essential fatty acids and have a high saturated fatty acid content, our generic pond scum, are very low food quality. We can feed our bugs these things, and they're pretty much lucky if they stay alive on diets of this, even though they get a tremendous amount of it. It's nutritionally inadequate. And this is just a summary of a bunch of different experiments that we've done in my lab. But basically what we're looking at here is, if we give them algae that has a different omega-3 fatty acid content, how does their growth and how does their reproduction and how does their fatty acid content vary? So we've got all the polyunsaturates, and then we've got the ones that are most physiologically important, the highly unsaturated fatty acids. And how does their total fatty acid content vary? So there's a lot of information on this slide, but basically what this slide is telling you, it's a compilation of lots of different experiments. If we feed herbivorous zooplankton the stuff that's rich in omega-3s, by the time they're reproductive, which for them takes about 1 week, they're 3.5 times larger, so they're much more efficient in how they convert the food that they're eating to their own biomass. They grow much faster. They have almost 5 times more of these important molecules, and they have a 4 times higher fat content. So they're bigger, they're fatter, and they have a higher proportion of the right types of fats. And if you work these numbers through and you say, okay, if I was going to feed a bug a given amount of a certain type of algae, how would that manifest itself? How would that transfer up the food web in terms of how much of these molecules are available to fish that are eating these bugs? It's a factor 60 difference between feeding them good food and bad food, because they're bigger, they're fatter, and they have more of the right stuff. And the important thing to keep in mind is that these HUFAs are extremely important for the growth of the small fish. There's, you know, hundreds of papers in aquaculture literature that are pointing out, you know, how it affects their growth, their disease resistance, pigmentation, acuity, visual acuity, the whole gamut. I mean, there's just example after example of ways that these are important. So one of the things I want to do now is kind of focus a little bit on how are these molecules conveyed through food web. How do they get from algae up to fish, and how does it depend on what types of herbivores consume them, and a variety of other things. So one of the things, this was parts of these slides were stolen from a presentation I gave at an international conference recently, and I made the joke that all the good data comes out of the classic papers. There's some really classic research that was done. So this guy named Tibor Farkas got into the National Academy of Science. He started out his research in Hungary, and what he did is he just played around with zooplankton. He took zooplankton samples for his PhD, and he looked at the melting point of the lipids in the zooplankton, and he figured out that the melting point of the lipids was always a little bit below the temperature, so that they regulated the lipid content in their bodies so that they wouldn't have this crystallization occurring in the water, and they just kept one step ahead of the water temperature. And the guy ended up finishing up his research looking at brain fatty acids, you know, publishing paper after paper after paper at the National Academy of Science and Science looking at brains, human vertebrate brains. But basically just showing that these organisms regulated the fluidity of their membranes on a seasonal basis just by varying the composition of fatty acids. And other fantastic papers that are kind of the classics that one kind of got everything started, but then later on I have to give up on all of these as actual examples because none of these people had the good sense to publish their papers in PDF, so it's hard for me to grab their figures and their tables to use for this. So the basic story here is that there's different types of herbivorous critters out there. I'm, you know, focusing on now the organisms I work with. I primarily work on zooplankton, but they're basically the same story with stream invertebrates. There's a variety of stream invertebrates, and they have different types of fatty acid composition. This right here is a critter I've worked with for a very long time known as Daphnia. And there's a few people in this room that have taken classes with me and know I usually get kind of teary-eyed when I talk about Daphnia, but they're pretty cool critters. They're parthenogenetic. They're very important herbivores in the lake. You know, a couple little factoids about these buggers here is that if you look at sockeye salmon in Lake Washington, 90% of their diet could be Daphnia, even when diet Daphnia are maybe only, you know, 10 or 15% of what's out there. This is what they eat. They eat Daphnia. And Daphnia are very important because they grow very fast, and they're very effective at eating algae. So they're the one group of zooplankton that we know is able to suppress algal blooms. And there's a lot of research on using zooplankton to control algal blooms in lakes, and it all hinges on this critter right here. And the other thing is that in the real world, they're about 99.9% females because they reproduce parthenogenetically. So they just make copies of themselves when everything is going well. When things are going really bad, they revert to sexual reproduction. So I don't know what that tells us, but they only do it when things are really bad. If you start starving them or abusing them in some way, then they switch. But this right here is copepod, another common type of zooplankton in lakes. And this is just a study that was published just a couple years ago showing that the fatty acid content of these different types of zooplankton varies pretty dramatically, and it varies quite a bit from the food they're eating. So there's a couple of things going on. The bugs differ systematically in which fatty acids are accumulating, but they're also, all of them, are quite enriched with the highly unsaturates and the polyunsaturates relative to their diets. So the less physiologically important saturated fatty acids, the monounsaturated fatty acids, drop off considerably as you go up the food web. So as you go up the food web, the more physiologically important molecules become more and more concentrated as you go up. And this right here is just some data we collected from Lake Washington not too long ago. It's a paper we just recently submitted showing here cestan. Cestan is a fancy word for the particulate matter in lakes, mostly algae, but it could be some detritus, dead algae. It's basically the food that herbivores eat. Cladocerans is this Daphnia group. And then this over here is our copepods. I've already shown you an image of those. And it's just showing that we can separate them out pretty nicely based on their fatty acid profiles. They have very characteristic fatty acid profiles. And then this just shows, if we go to a higher level of detail, that within these groups, you can even make some distinctions. So there's three different types of copepods that we sampled in Lake Washington, and they cluster out somewhat separately. One group's down here, one group's up here, and then you got that group down there. So there's pretty systematic differences. But another thing that's very important is, how is their fatty acid content affected by diet? And one of the really hot areas of research right now in ecology is the use of something called biomarkers. So biomarkers is a big deal. For a long time, ecologists have been working with something called stable isotopes. So we have stable isotopes of nitrogen, stable isotopes of carbon. Nowadays, people are getting a little bit fired up on stable isotopes of hydrogen. There's also stable isotopes of sulfur that you can be used. And for various reasons, these molecules tell us different things about how energy is conveyed through food webs. But one of the problems, if you take, for example, stable isotopes of carbon, a lot of people have found is that you're looking at very different food sources, and you're looking at the different stable isotope ratios of different food sources. Sometimes, and this is not uncommon at all, they're not very different. You could have completely different types of foods, but similar stable isotope composition. And if you have your end members have similar ratios, it's impossible to distinguish, you know, which one is making what contribution to upper trophic levels, because they're starting out looking the same. You can't tease that apart. And it's a surprisingly common problem. The interesting thing about fatty acids from this perspective is that there's a tremendous diversity of fatty acids. So every major plant group is going to have a very different fatty acid profile, because we're not talking about two molecules here. We're talking about anywhere, in a common sample, we may detect between 20 and 40 fatty acid molecules. And so there's a lot of information contained in that. Now, one of the things that's problematic about using these biomarkers is that the bugs can switch the molecules around a little bit. There's some ability to change one molecule from one form to another. But actually, it seems to be pretty limited. And we have some pretty neat research showing that the fatty acid content of these bugs is very strong, very strongly influenced by their diet. Has some pretty cool data from some papers we published recently showing that they pretty much end up looking like their diet in terms of fatty acids. Although there are, I just said here, differences between groups. And so, I'll run out of time. I'm going to skip a few slides here. These are just showing some diet things, but what I want to do is, here's a good example right here of a diet response. This is just from a paper we published a year ago. And this is just summing up the molecules that are most important. So the physiologically critical molecules when we talk about essential fatty acids are these three molecules here: EPA, DHA, and ARA. ARA and EPA are precursors for hormones. DHA seems to be really important for structural lipids. It's the one that I mentioned before, is part of your brain, it's like 40% of your eye tissue, and very important for nervous tissues, and now I know very important for the pectoral muscles of hummingbirds. Also, apparently, the muscles on the tails of rattlesnakes, for some reason. I guess because they have to beat those things pretty fast. But anyway, this is just a plot here, and this is what it looks like if we compare the content of these, the proportion of these molecules in the diet versus the proportion of these molecules in the bugs. And you see that if there's a lot of this stuff in a diet, they accumulate a lot. And you also see that they offset. They always have about 4% more than their diet. So they have to have some of this. They do what they can to convert the precursor molecules, which are the alpha-linolenic and linoleic acid, into these. But they have a limited capacity to do that. And if they can get the direct stuff, they'll accumulate very high proportions of this stuff, really high. And when they're up in this range, this is when these bugs are just growing like crazy. Like, for example, they'll reproduce after about 1 week. If we feed them the really fatty acid deficient food, for one thing, they're kind of lucky if they make it to the point of reproducing. But if they do reproduce, they'll produce about maybe one or two eggs. If we feed them the stuff that's really rich, on their first reproductive event, we have them averaging about 10 eggs per individual, which is a huge difference in terms of population growth. And we've also done some simulation modeling showing that if they're given the right type of food, they're much more resilient to predation by fish, so that if you give them really nutritious food, the fish can be chomping them down, eating 20% of the population every day, but the population will maintain its biomass because it's able to replace itself. But if you feed it the really low-quality food, even 5% per day will bring the population down to undetectable levels because they can't replace themselves. They're not growing fast enough to keep up with those losses. All right, buddy, got about 500 slides here, so I'm going to jump to the chase here a little bit. So this is just a study done by my colleague, Dorte Mueller-Navarra, and what she's done in this paper, and I'll show you some similar results, is she's compared the fatty acid content of various types of algae. So she's got three different types of algae here, and then compared that to the bugs. And this is just using something called a discriminant function analysis. Take way too long to explain exactly what that is, but it's like principal component analysis, except it has categories. And that probably doesn't mean very much to most of you as well. But it's a statistical technique for using a whole lot of data to categorize things. So in this particular case, we have like 30 different fatty acids, and we want to categorize things using these 30 different pieces of information for each sample. And so what it shows is that the bugs cluster out very similar to their diet. Basically, it's saying that their fatty acid profiles match their diet very closely. And, you know, kind of in the, you know, the vernacular would be, you are what you eat. Literally, it's saying these bugs are what they eat. If they have stuff that has a very high omega-3 fatty acid content, they're just loaded full of omega-3s. If they eat stuff that doesn't, they don't have them. And this is just showing that basically the same story with their eggs. It's for a larger database, I'm in the process of editing a book called Aquatic Lipids, and it has like 15 chapters, and I'm writing one of those chapters on zooplankton fatty acids. And so I summarized a lot of data for the process of writing this review chapter. And one of the things that a lot of people have figured out, that this idea of investing the juveniles with high composition of essential fatty acids is also found if you look in the zooplankton, that the females tend to invest about twice as much of this in their juveniles as they have in their own tissue. So people do things. They take these little bugs, which are about a millimeter long, and when they see that they have eggs, they take little things and they pull the eggs out of them and measure the fatty acid content of the eggs and on the body, and they find that the eggs tend to have about twice as much of these molecules. But still, the eggs and the bugs look very much like the diet. And this is kind of a summary figure that I've included in this chapter. And all this is showing here to begin with is that this point that I made before is that the algae are very different in their fatty acid content, and you can use those differences to categorize the algae or to actually differentiate them. You could give me a sample, and I could tell by looking at the fatty acid content of that sample which type of algae are likely dominating in that sample. That's how characteristic they are. And so this is just a bunch of data that I summarized for this review paper showing that, you know, they have very characteristic fatty acid profiles. And these circles are the centroids for 10 samples for each particular fatty acid, for each phytoplankton group I looked at. And then this circle around it is a standard deviation around that centroid. So it just says that 2/3 of the observations fall within that circle for the 10 algal samples that I summarized. So this is what the algae look like, and this is what the bugs look like. So the interesting thing here is, as I showed you in the preceding plot, is that the bugs cluster out with their diet, but you'll see that with one exception, the bugs are always on the inside of these centroids, so that there's some features of these bugs' fatty acid profile that are consistent and that are somewhat resilient in the face of very different fatty acid content in their diets, but by and large, these things are mostly a function of what they're eating. So there's some characteristics that these bugs have, but there's this very strong impact of diet. So you see, I think we break it down in terms of what's most important. These things have, this particular group of bugs has about a 20% kind of consistency in their fatty acids, and about 80% they just respond to what their diet is. So another thing that's interesting is that some of the bugs they have some regulation of their fatty acid content. And this is a group of copepods that we collected from Lake Washington. And what this shows is the saturated fatty acid content of the particulate matter in Lake Washington in this bold line. And then in this check line is of the particulate matter. So this is the food. And then the bold line is the bugs. And what you see is that when the food has a low saturated fatty acid content, when the water's cold, the bugs have more. And when the food has a very high saturated fatty acid content, the bugs have considerably less. But the patterns are very similar. It's just that the bug varies much less than its diet does. So And in our field, we call that homeostasis, that there's some consistency to it, but you can see both the consistency here and you can see the clear response to the diet in this kind of a time series plot. And you see the same kind of thing for some other bugs where we feed them in the laboratory. These red lines are just the one-to-one between the diet and the bug's content. And you see that for some of these molecules, there's a big tendency to have more than their diet so that they accumulate more than their diet. But then if their diet has a very high content, they tend to have less. So there's this linear relationship between diet and the composition within the bugs, but it's not a one-to-one relationship. When there's very little in their diet, they're very efficient at trying to accumulate more of the stuff. And then when there's a whole lot of it, they say, you know, I don't need quite this much. I could live with a little bit less than this. So that's what we call homeostasis. One of the other things that's very important here is that, as I pointed out, that the fatty acid composition of these bugs is strongly influenced by diet. The molecules that were interesting all start out in algae for practical purposes. They start out in algae. So diet influences the bugs. But one of the other things that's important that can happen in these food webs is that the molecules can be transformed from less physiologically important molecules to the very physiologically important molecules. And so the basic story is that no animal can make an omega-3 or omega-6 fatty acid. But within the omega-3 category, there's about four common molecules, two of which are physiologically very important, and two of which are only important as precursors to the more important molecules. And we vary a great deal in terms of how efficient we are at taking the precursors and turning them into the physiologically active molecules. So in humans, you all know that people talk about stuff like, if you want to get lots of omega-3s, eat linseed oil. You know, it has lots of omega-3. Well, what it has is alpha-linolenic acid. And people are very interested in human nutrition of how much alpha-linolenic acid would you need to create the same physiological benefit that you would get from EPA or DHA. And in humans, it's roughly about 10 to 1. You need to give us about 10 times as much alpha-linolenic acid to get the same benefits in terms of lipid properties within our blood as we would if we just gave people a direct source of the physiologically important molecule. So it's about 10 to 1 in terms of bioconversion, which means that there's a lot of inefficiency there. In marine fish, it's believed that they're completely incapable of doing this, that they've evolved in an environment that has not very many of the precursor molecules and a lot of the physiologically important molecules. They just can't do it. Freshwater fish, it's believed they can. So it's kind of this weird thing. There's this big difference between freshwater fish and marine fish. And there's a lot of variation between whether organisms are lower in the food web or higher in the food web. So carnivorous animals, things like cats, house cats, cannot do this. They must have the physiologically active molecule in a direct form. They cannot make these conversions, whereas herbivorous organisms tend to be better at it. And there's a lot of interest in to what extent is the bug's growth constrained by inefficiencies in its ability to convert from the precursor molecule to the physiologically important molecule. That's an area where people are tremendously interested, both in human but animal nutrition and even in the kind of stuff I do. So what we have here is some evidence that there's some interesting transformations going on in Lake Washington. Some of these colors don't show up too much, but this is basically the food in Lake Washington over the course of a year. And this is EPA and DHA, so two very important molecules. And then HUFA is just the sum of these two molecules. And that's in the food. So the food is dominated by EPA. And then we look at the bugs out there. So the bugs, this copepod, is the type of zooplankton that's found year-round in Lake Washington, which is the reason why we have a good sample, because some of the other ones are only found there 3 or 4 months a year, but this one's found year-round. And what we see here is that the bug's fatty acid content is dominated by DHA. So the food is EPA, the bug is DHA. These molecules differ in terms of carbon chain length. One has a 20 carbon chain length, the other has a 22, but they also differ in degrees of unsaturation. One has 5 unsaturated bonds, one has 6. But they're both omega-3 fatty acids. So pretty different stories here from the food to the bug. And if we look at correlations, if we look at how the EPA content of the cestan correlates to that in the bug, we see cestan, you know, in the bug is flatline. There's no relationship. If we look at DHA, we get a bit of a relationship between DHA here in the food and in the bug. And if we sum those molecules, we get a little bit better relationship. But interestingly enough, if we correlate EPA to DHA, we get a really strong correlation, suggesting that EPA is what dominates in the food, DHA is what dominates in the bug. And the reason for that is that the bug is pretty darn good at turning EPA into DHA, which tells us the bug is taking the molecule and turning it into something that's more important for fish physiology, because DHA is the most important molecule for fish physiology. And this is just what it looks like if we plot them head to head. So I am running out of time. I will show you one final thing. One of the things that we're very interested with is this cold water adaptation, how do organisms modify their membrane properties. There's been a tremendous amount of research on this across many different phyla. People trying to figure out how do plants, animals, vary their lipid properties to deal with temperature stress. And this is just some data published from some of my colleagues recently showing that if you grow them at 22 degrees Celsius and 11 degrees Celsius, the bugs have very different fatty acid content. In particular, you want to pay attention to this one right here. This is EPA. This is the one that has a melting point of about minus 50 degrees Celsius. It's 3% when they're grown at 20 degrees, and it's 13% when they're grown at 10 degrees. So they have a much higher content of this more important molecule. And this study also shows that these bugs have a capacity to convert from the precursor molecule, this is alpha-linolenic acid, to the physiologically important molecule, which was not detected in the diet, but it was 3% of what the bug had. And what we find is if we feed the bug this type of diet, this is a green algae diet, they'll have about 1% EPA typically in our experiments. If we feed them the better food, they have up to 15%, or they average around 15%. So tremendous difference in how much of the stuff they have depending upon what we feed them. And I was asked to leave 5 minutes for questions, so I could stop right here. Yeah. Question back there.
Do you have any knowledge about
Well, the thing about fish is that there's pretty systematic differences in fish in terms of where they store their fatty acids. So the white meat fish tend to store their fatty acids in their liver, and then the oily fish tend to store it in their flesh. So the tunas and the salmon store it in their flesh, and they have a very high omega-3 fatty acid content. Like the cods, the white meat fish store it in their livers, and that's, you know, back, you go back to the cod liver oil, you know, that torture that was used, you know, almost a century ago against children was a common way of getting these molecules into kids. But the problem is that cod liver oil also has a very high cholesterol content. It has some other things in it you actually don't want to be giving to your kids, so it's not really a good way of doing it. I don't think the differences are so much where the fish lives is what type of fish it is. So if you manage to find a trout that, you know, if you find a trout that feeds on the bottom, it's still going to have a trout fatty acid profile that's going to be strongly influenced by its diet. It's going to be very strongly influenced by its diet. And then you have a pelagic species. Its diet is going to be, again, it's really going to depend on where it is in the food chain and the type of lipid properties that that thing has. There's one study that was really interesting. It was a study published about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, and it was looking at sargassum sea food webs. And sargassum sea, you've got this brown algae mats out there, and then there's green algae that grows on it. So you've got brown algae, and then you've got green algae, Cladophora, and then you've got diatoms floating by. And all of these different types of plants have vastly different fatty acid profiles. And so what these guys did is they looked at the smallest invertebrates, larval, crustaceans, small fish, big fish, and then the sargassum sea mats have big fish like wahoo, and they have the mahi-mahi associated with them. And they found the entire food web was supported by the diatom fatty acids, that the brown algae was just a place for all the critters to hide. Nobody was actually eating this stuff. The green algae that was growing on the brown algae wasn't contributing to the food web. The food web was energetically entirely based on the diatoms floating by. And they were just using this other stuff as a place to hide. So that's a long, roundabout way of not directly answering your question. But it really depends on what kind of fish they are and what they're eating. That's what's important.
I have nitrate in my pot. Let's take